Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here, and I'm really glad you've joined us today because I have been confused about something really important for a really long time. I mean, longer than I should have been confused about it. I got a few ideas about it, but it's not all really come together for me in my mind until I prepared for this conversation that we're going to have today with my guest. His name is Dr. Neil Shenvey, and he's got all kinds of bona fides as a particle physicist or something, quantum physics guy. I'm looking at it, Neil, here at Princeton, Berkeley, Yale, Duke. I mean, that's quite a pedigree. And then you left it all to homeschool your kids? Did I get that right?
That's right.
Doesn't that make you just a little bit overqualified for that job?
It's a pretty hard job.
I guess you haven't gotten to quantum physics yet with your kids, though, huh?
We're on our way. My oldest son really wants to study cosmology. He's 11. He's begging. So I said, you got to learn some calculus first. So we're on our way.
Good for you. Well, you have all these bona fides in this particular field, and maybe someday we'll have a nice long conversation on the show about quantum physics, but that's not the expertise that you have that I'm interested in today. I'm interested in talking to you about another topic, and that topic, I guess, is maybe popularly known by the phrase critical theory. And if somebody's not in the academy or very tied into popular culture, especially at a younger level, they may not have heard the term, but I guarantee, friends, you have heard the terms associated with it, and you have been assaulted with the ideas. And one of the things about being an ambassador for Christ, and we've talked about this a lot, is knowledge, wisdom, character. Knowledge is an accurately informed mind. Wisdom is an artful method. And character is an attractive manner. That's the way we characterize that package at Stand to Reason. But knowledge is not just knowing stuff. It's an accurately informed mind. In other words, it's got to be properly informed, but it's got to be informed in a way that we can connect classical Christianity in the context of our current culture. So if we know our stuff, but we don't understand the culture that we need to take our stuff into, well, we're not going to be very effective as ambassadors. And this is why I've asked Neil to come on the show today, because Dr. Shenvey is an expert in the area of critical theory. And I am a little curious about this. We'll talk about what it is in a moment, get into more detail here, Neil. But I how is it that as a particle physicist or quantum physics guy with an education at Princeton, Berkeley, Yale, and Duke University, that you find yourself now really as somebody, one of the most well-informed communicators on the issue of critical theory. By the way, just so you know, when I kept asking around, who could I find that could help me with this? Your name kept popping up all over the place. So you're the man. But how did that happen? Because critical theory is sociology, really.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And I definitely wouldn't call myself an expert. I try to reserve that term for people with PhDs in relevant fields. I mean, my collaborator, Dr. Pat Sawyer, is an expert. He has a PhD in cultural studies and teaches. He's a professor at UNCG Greensboro. And so he does this professionally. So we collaborate quite a bit. And he assures me that I have a pretty good grasp on this field of knowledge. That's reassuring. Because as you say, my official training is in an entirely unrelated field. But I've really, in the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 years, been motivated to learn about this topic because I've seen it, as you'll see, I think, soon enough, popping up everywhere. I mean, in our politics, in our culture, in the entertainment industry, and in the evangelical church, you see these phrases like intersectionality, heteronormativity, things like that, gender identity, transphobia. All of these ideas emerge from a very broad discipline that's known as critical theory. And so when I began to see that coming up more and more frequently, both in the church and in the culture, I got concerned because I became a Christian in graduate school at UC Berkeley, and I got interested in apologetics quite early as a Christian. So I learned things like how to relate faith and science, how to talk about the resurrection, the evidence for Jesus, for the reliability of the Gospels, the trilemma, things like that, very standard apologetics.
Sure. I've seen them on your website, too. You've done training with young people, et cetera. So you certainly have your feet firmly planted there in the apologetics fields.
Sure. And that's what I was doing. I was writing a book on apologetics. I just actually finished. But then I was kind of I put it on a hold and just put the brakes on because I realized people were not asking questions about truth. They were asking questions about things like oppression and justice. And is Christianity working on behalf of the marginalized to liberate them? Mm-hmm. And I was like, don't you want to know whether it's true first? And they said, no. Or that was kind of the sense that I got. People were more concerned about whether or not it was on the side of justice mm-hmm. and social justice. And that at first I brushed that off and said, well, I think that's kind of postmodernism or something, but it became more and more pertinent. And I saw it affecting people's theology. So this is not just non-Christians outside the church, but I saw Christians right. that I knew personally mm-hmm. embracing these increasingly heterodox ideas and even in some cases abandoning Christianity completely mm-hmm. because what was really driving them was not concerns about what we would think about, like who Jesus was, what's the gospel, how can I be rescued from my sin, but they were more and more concerned about justice for the marginalized. And
now,
that's how I got
involved. Well, I want to say something about that because I can see how there could be initially a tremendous appeal to conscientious Christians because we care about justice. And if we hear the phrase social justice and don't understand that it's a term of art in the system that we're going to talk about that has a very specialized kind of a meaning and plays a very particular part, it's hard for Christians to say, well, why wouldn't I be concerned about social justice? That is, justice in the society is the way they might characterize it. And the prophets talked about that. Jesus cared about the marginalized is the way a lot of people would put it. I think that's actually overplayed a bit. He cared about people who were willing to respond to him, and those turned out to be the marginalized. But even the rich folk on occasion responded to him, and he welcomed them as well. But in any event, I can see how certain aspects of this movement that's characterized by critical theory, the language involved oppressors and justice, especially social justice and working to deal with racism and all of these kinds of things that have been historically terrible vices in our culture. You can see how somebody who's a virtuous Christian would be attracted in general to the ethical concerns that are expressed in a movement like that. But there's more to it than just that, isn't there? There's a whole worldview that's involved.
Yeah, a lot more. You're exactly right. People get sucked into this worldview, really, because they rightly care about racism, sexism, poverty, justice. Those are all completely valid and mandated concerns for Christians. But you have to understand how all of these ideas and terms are redefined. So, for example, the word oppression is redefined very well. It's often not explicit, but if you poke around the literature, you find, oh, yeah, they have really said this is not what it traditionally means. So we can get into that. But, yeah, I don't want to take away from people's zeal for true biblical justice, not at all. I want them to oppose racism and sexism and to care about the poor, but I want them to understand how those ideas are being conceptualized by this discipline of contemporary critical theory.
Yeah, that's good. It's important for, as far as I'm concerned, for my listeners to understand that people can approach the same ethical concern from very, very different viewpoints. And can we make common cause with them? I think we can on many things. On ethical concerns. So if an atheist wants to make common cause with me on abortion, for example, it's fine with me if he doesn't believe in God, if he's against abortion for the reasons, you know, that we advance. The problem is, I think, and this is part of what I want to address here, is that Christians unwittingly get drawn into a whole system of thinking that turns out to be hostile to Christianity. So let me just tell you right off the bat, Neil, my biggest concern, even this could sound weird as an apologist, but my biggest concern on this issue is not first to give an understanding to Christians so they can formulate apologetics type approaches to postmoderns that are involved in critical theory. Okay, it's not my biggest concern. That's a secondary concern. My biggest concern is for the Christians. Yeah. My biggest concern is for the church, because I see them getting drawn into things unwittingly. And part of what I want to do is take these notions, like what you've done, you learn from the smart guys, then you translate them into ideas and understandings that are available to the rank and file, so we can see the minefields that are out there. So why don't we talk just a little bit in a more general terms about critical theory? And my understanding is it kind of started after fashion with Marxism, but yeah, kind of grew out of that. It's even calling it a neo-Marxism is probably understating where it's come. So give us a little understanding about the background, its relationship to Marxism, and how it's been changed over the last 100 years.
Yeah, this is a very complicated subject. So yeah, critical theory did originate with Karl Marx's ideas, not his economics, but his ideas right, about how power works and how power divides people, with this division between oppressors and oppressed. He saw in economic terms, but also how power tends to color your knowledge. So what you know is determined by your social location. That became very important. The term critical theory was developed
Neil, explain the term social location.
Oh yeah. So whether you're part of a dominant cultural group or whether you're part of a subordinate oppressed cultural group will determine how you view reality. It'll shape how you view, it'll shape your consciousness. That was Marx's actual language, the false consciousness. And so that idea was picked up by the Frankfurt School in the 20s and 30s, and later by feminists, by critical race theorists, by queer theorists. So critical theory nowadays, not since Marx's time, it's been 150 years since then, it has grown into this humongous, broad, nebulous field that encompasses queer theory, critical race theory, critical legal studies, critical pedagogy. So it's very hard to define. I like to focus on ideas, not the labels we use. People call this cultural Marxism or neo-Marxism or even postmodernism, identity politics. But the ideas are what's important because they go by a lot of different names. So let me focus on the ideas, and that'll explain, I think, why we're concerned about the worldview that underlies this whole lens of viewing reality.
Okay.
So the first concept would be the social binary. The idea that all of culture is divided into oppressor groups and oppressed groups along lines of race, class, gender, sexuality, physical ability, etc. And so that's like a direct quote from Cinzia and D'Angelo. Here's another quote from Maureen Adams. She writes, "The manifestations of social oppression in the U.S. that are focused on in this book are ableism, ageism, anti-Semitism, classism, heterosexism, racism, religious oppression, sexism, and transgender oppression." And they have charts and diagrams showing how you can divide reality into the oppressor groups and the oppressed groups along these different axes.
So that's the distinction. Let me pause here for a moment, because I think this is really critical in kind of visualizing how this whole worldview works. In the Christian worldview, we have distinctions, of course, but I was going to say for a moment, it's like sinners and non-sinners, but there are no non-sinners. There was only one, you know.
Right. Yes.
So we have maybe pre-fallen man and now fallen man. And so this is the way we dichotomize. We are all in the group of fallen, and that creates a certain need that we have, and that begins to define how our world works. In this way of thinking, though, the definition is between oppressed and the oppressor. And the oppressed fall into these categories that are characteristically identified with identity politics categories. So that phrase you mentioned a few moments ago ties into this aspect of critical theory. That's where identity politics comes from, all these allegedly oppressed groups.
Sort of, because you can conceivably have identity politics based on dominant status. So you can say white people can practice identity politics, or men, or they can further their own interests. And in fact, critical theorists would say that actually rich white males already do that. They already play identity politics. That's why the system favors them.
Oh, I see. So
that's
it could be used. Identity politics could be used on either side of the structure, is what you're saying.
Yes,
it's not just – okay. No, that's good.
That's the key, because people don't realize there is an asymmetry baked into critical theory at its very foundation, and not just in terms of our things like our moral status, like you said, whether we're sinners or the innocent, we're the victims, the victimizers. That's baked into the ideology. Our knowledge, people that are oppressed have a greater access to truths about reality because they can see through this social construction of power and values that oppressors can't see. They're blinded by their privilege. So a white male would think that, oh, we live in a meritocracy. Everything's great and just and good. But actually, they're blinded by the fact that they have both conscious and unconscious reasons to ignore the reality of oppression.
That's the claim. That's the claim.
That's the claim.
Critical theory.
That's the claim.
Right, right.
So this is, again, there, and boy, oh boy, we can get down to some really dangerous theology there, because what you're basically doing is you're saying that as a, say, rich white male, you cannot adjudicate whether my claims as an oppressed person are theologically true. You might think they're false, but that's actually a function of your blindness. And you have to defer to my authority as a person from an oppressed group.
So, you know, you know, let me pause here just to make a reflection, because as I thought about these two categories, the oppressed and the oppressors, it strikes me it would be a fair thing to say that everybody probably falls in each group at some time in their life. I mean, that's what it means to live in a fallen world.
Yeah.
We are sinners, and therefore we take our sinful actions out on other people. We oppress them, and we are the victims of other people's sinful actions. So, but in this characterization, these groups seem to be very kind of rigidly described, such that, and I've wrote a note down here so I get it right here, everyone is either in a victim or oppressed, or an oppressor, not based on things about their individual lives, but solely based on the membership that they have in a group. So I think you're from India. Is that right?
Well, I'm half Indian. Yes.
Half Indian. So you're half oppressed in some certain kind of fashion. See, I'm Lily White, and I'm a Protestant, and I'm cisgender, and I'm heteronormative, and I'm a Christian. I mean, I am the worst beast on the planet here, because all my intersectionality is with all the wrong groups. But it's only because of those qualities or those membership of those groups that I'm demonized, and people can do that not knowing a single thing about me, or about my actions towards others, or my value system, or anything.
Right. So oppression, this, we'll get into this in a second. I want to say that intersectionality actually kind of a little bit troubles the notion of these rigid groups, because you can be both an oppressor and the oppressed at the same time. But again, not based on your actions, right? Based on your group. So for example, they would say that a black male would be oppressed with respect to his race because he's black, but he would be privileged with respect to his gender.
Uh-huh.
So that intersectionality in that way, now it doesn't say, none of this has to do with his actions. It has nothing to do with whether he's the kindest, gentlest, most wonderful man in the universe. But if he's part of these groups, that's what stains him as either an oppressor, or what valorizes him as oppressed. Mm-hmm. So again, it's collectivist. It views people not as, I mean, it's complicated, but again, they're focusing on the structures of society, not on your individual thoughts, words, or deeds, which Christianity would say, actually, that's the center, your character. It's who you are as an individual that defines you, not your demographic group.
You know, primarily. It's interesting. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. And in the mid 60s, of course, the great civil rights movement, the preferential term during that time to deal with these issues was prejudice.
Yeah.
It was very interesting when you look at a movie made during that time, like the 12 Cowboy Guys. What am I thinking of? You know, it's a remake of the Japanese. How could I forget this one? Neil Brenner and Steve McQueen, you know, and all that. Anyway, they're rescuing this group of people. How could I forget this? Everybody knows the name of this movie. Okay, it's an old timer's disease moment here. But anyway, in the movie, there's our acts of prejudice going on, and they talk about it. Hey, that guy's prejudiced. I didn't realize he was prejudiced. These are cowboys using these terms. It's anachronistic. Okay, it's really weird to hear that. But what prejudice means is you're prejudging someone in virtue of their arbitrary membership in a group. So there's a black guy, and so you are prejudging that individual based on your view of the group, which is kind of a classic understanding of racism. One race is inherently inferior to another race, and this is all done group wise. But now, tell me if I'm understanding this right, they have kind of turned the tables on prejudice, and this is what's at the core, in one sense, of the critical theory, is a legitimate prejudging, they think legitimate, of an individual simply in virtue of his membership in a group. And in this case, it includes racial groups. So white guys are bad, especially if they're old white guys like me, simply because they're old white guys.
Yeah, here's some quotes. This is from an evangelical author with 16,000 Twitter followers in a book that he wrote about race and the gospel. He wrote things like this: "My problem as a white man was that I didn't know how to live in skin. Racial blindness was in my DNA. Racism as white people, racism isn't only part of who we've been. It is, in ways we don't even understand or comprehend, who we are. White people suffer from a malady called shriveled heart syndrome." Now, you see those things about anyone but white people, it'd be like, that's horrifically racist. You're prejudging someone based on the fact that they happen to have white-colored skin. Uh-huh. But now, how can that happen? Well, because critical theorists have redefined racism as prejudice plus institutional power. Uh-huh. So by definition, a person of color cannot be racist. They can be prejudiced. They can be prejudiced. However, they cannot be racist because racist has been redefined.
Yeah.
And you think, well, is that just semantics? Well, no, because then it's equivocation, because then they'll say, if they do something that's prejudiced, you'll say, hey, that sounds racist. Oh, it's not racist because by definition, I can't be racist.
Yeah, right.
And so it often there's an incredible amount of equivocation that goes on because these terms have all been redefined. Let me go back to oppression. This is a huge thing because Christians will care about oppression and want to oppose oppression defined biblically, which, you know, cruelty, violence, coercion. But critical theory has redefined oppression. Here's a great quote from Iris Young. She says, she's talking about how they have redefined oppression. She says, in its new usage, oppression designates a disadvantage and injustice some people face, not because a tyrannical power coerces them, but because of the everyday practices of a well-intentioned liberal society.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
This is incredible. She's saying oppression happens not because some tyrant is violence against you, steals from you, robs you, takes away your rights, but because well-meaning people are living out these structures and symbols that devalue certain groups. So they would say that this is called hegemonic power.
Right.
That refers to the idea that certain groups have imposed their values and their culture on society, and it's taken as normal, and those values justify their own dominance and supremacy. So,
you know, go ahead. I was going to say, what's interesting, we're going to go to break for in just a moment, but what's interesting about this whole thing, as I'm listening to it, kind of with the apologetics mindset, is it becomes very, very difficult, in a sense, to prove them wrong, to show that they're mistaken in their assessment of the culture, because they can always equivocate in some way. They can always disqualify in some case, they can always dismiss in some way. And we'll talk about that in a moment. We talk about lived experience as one of the characteristics of critical theory. But my guest right now is Dr. Neil Shenvey. He's got a PhD in, is it quantum physics? Is that what it is? The
theoretical chemistry, but yeah, quantum physics, basically.
But he's really a smart guy in the area that we're talking with him about now, and that is critical theory. And we'll get back to that in just a moment. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. Should Christians divide over homosexuality? Or is this a topic that we can just agree to disagree on? Find out my answer in the latest episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for it on iTunes or the top of the homepage at str.org.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate and choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
All right, friends, Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. My guest today, Dr. Neil Shenvey, and we're talking about the issue of critical theory. And by the way, in the break, Neil, I checked it out, The Magnificent Seven.
Oh, okay, yeah.
How could I possibly forget the name of that movie? In fact, my wife and I and our girls, we watched it again just about 6 months ago, just because it's one of those timeless things. But there they were talking about prejudice, and it's just so ironic for me, having grown up in the 50s and 60s and watching the whole civil rights movement and seeing the tremendous progress after that in the area of race relations, et cetera, to have the whole thing seemingly now turned on its head, and instead of creating a colorblind society, now race is everything and gender is everything, and sexual behavior and sexual behavior associated with individual identity is everything. In other words, people identify according to their sexual behavior, not according to other things. And which, when you think about it, is odd that I identify myself according to my sexual passions, you know. But in any event, this is where we're at. And this has created an environment, not just a cultural one, but a political one, that is teeming with all of these terms and references and ideas that I think many of us don't completely understand what's going on and how this is so inimical to Christianity. And so we were describing, Neil, the basic outline of what critical theory entailed. You talked about the social binary, and that is that one thing is that they see cultures in terms of two separate groups, the oppressed and the oppressors. And there are different subcategories in each side, and so you might be an oppressor on one category, like a black person, but oppressor being a male, but in another category, being black, you're oppressed as well. And so there's these interwoven categories that get really crazy and complicated, what people call intersectionality. You also started to hint at started to develop this idea, oppression through ideology or hegemonic power. Tell us a little bit about that. Flesh that out for us.
Right. So the idea is that what we take for granted as normal, natural, objective, universal claims about what's good and right are actually the constructions or the impositions of the dominant group. So this goes back to Marx, by the way, actually, and Antonio Gramsci later. The idea that the dominant groups, these oppressor groups, create these ideas that justify their own power and privilege. And then the oppressed people actually absorb those ideas also and say, yeah, we deserve to be on the bottom because we're not as smart or we're not as valuable as these mm-hmm. wonderful, powerful people. But then through their lived experience, the oppressed people can say, wait a minute. No, I know that I'm being oppressed. I can, through my lived experience, see the reality of our social, of our cultural, that has hegemonic power. I can see how it operates, and I can achieve what's called a liberatory consciousness. I can get woke. I can wake up to the reality of my oppression. And then I'm in a position of greater epistemic privilege, actually, with respect to oppressors, because I can see what they can't. They mm-hmm. they have a reason to deny or to downplay this reality of my oppression. And so I have to give credit to my own authority and valorize my lived experience as giving me the ability to speak on these issues. I don't need to appeal to, you know, empirical evidence or quote-unquote objective reason or quote-unquote science, because my truth, my lived experience, it trumps all of those supposed objective measures.
So this reminds me of, say, the hashtag MeToo movement, where there was legitimate or there were legitimate complaints about real sexual harassment and abuse. But then there seemed to be other testimonies that weren't as reliable that were popping up at the same time. But one side of the equation consistently supported the one who claimed to be abused. And now, and I think a lot of us on the outside were thinking, well, wait a minute, maybe that person wasn't abused. Why are they siding with them? But it makes sense the way you've just described it, because one feature of critical theory is the centrality of lived experience. That is, what a person believes to be true in their experience, in their culture, is what actually is true. Even if you can't see examples of racism or sexism or whatever in someone's life, if they feel there are examples, then that's enough to establish it as the reality. Did I get that right?
So no, this is the interesting thing. So people often confuse critical theory with postmodernism. So postmodernism, the radical ones, would say things like, "Yeah, truth is a social construct itself, and your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth. They're all equally true, equally false. It's all subjective." But critical theorists don't say that. So they actually are firmly realists, even they're moral realists, because oppression to them is objectively bad.
Yeah.
And so similarly, they would say, and actually Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined the term intersectionality in her essay Mapping the Margins, says, look, you can't relativize everything, because if you do, you relativize away oppression itself.
Right.
And in order to have real positive identity politics, to get solidarity, we have to establish that, yes, actually, we can't deconstruct everything. So here's the thing. They wouldn't say, because you feel oppressed, therefore it's true that you're oppressed. They wouldn't say that. That would be relativism. What okay. they would say is, if you feel oppressed, that you, and because you are an oppressed group, by the way, this doesn't work for men. So if a man feels oppressed, they would tell him, that's not true. You're not oppressed. Now, how would they know that? Because you're operating from a social location of the oppressor. So you don't have special access to truth, because you are operating in the system where you're privileged. Mm-hmm. However, if a woman feels oppressed, because she has a social location of an oppressed person, she has better epistemic access to the truth.
Yeah.
So that's why you can take her lived experience as veridical, as pointing to a reality.
Sure.
Otherwise, because they realize, if you said, well, lived experience counts perfectly, well, why can't a white male say, well, I feel oppressed too? They say, no, mm-hmm. you don't. Or they would say, you're wrong. Because mm-hmm. objectively, they would say, we live in a country where we have built into the system, we have racism, sexism, homophobia, cisgenderism. They're all baked into the system. And therefore, you can't claim that your lived experience is actually true.
You know, it's so interesting that they say the privileged classes, whatever those happen to be, the oppressor groups, do not have privilege epistemically. They don't have privileged knowledge.
Yes.
It's because of their part of the group, they cannot see reality the way it really is. Okay. But the other side, the oppressed groups, they have privileged
access.
Epistemology, because they can see the world the way it really is. So the question, I mean, I got that right so far.
Yeah,
so correct? Actually, that's what you mean by lived experience.
Yeah, so Jose Medina has a book called the Epistemology of Resistance, I think, where he notes that paradox. He said, paradoxically, privileged people have less privilege with respect to epistemology, whereas oppressed people have more privilege because they can see reality. It's not absolute, but they have better access to reality, and okay. oppressors have worse access.
Okay, so here's my question, though, and now this is going to be an epistemological concern. In other words, how do we know what we know? the critical theorists are making all kinds of claims about the way reality actually is.
Yes.
And what they say is a whole swath of the culture cannot see reality the way it really is. We're the only ones who see reality the way it really is, which is that we're the oppressed ones. And the reason we see it the way it really is because we're oppressed, which strikes me as dangerously close to circularity.
Yes.
So where are they? Where do they get the, in a certain sense, even in their own mind, the verification for this assessment of the culture that they're offering to the rest of us? And in some cases, oppressing the rest of us with, but that's another issue. Maybe we'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting because, again, this is well-developed. There's a lot of coherence here so that people often think they can do the sort of the postmodern jujitsu where they trick people into the self-refuting claims. But actually, if you understand that this is actually well-developed, it's wrong, but it's not contradictory in some ways. So what they would say is they would point to radical disparities as evidence of oppression. So, they would do that hesitantly. So it was amazing to me when I first began reading these scholars, it was amazing to me how little analysis they had at all. They had no data. They had no numbers. They had, what did they have? They had storytelling. Actually, one of the hallmarks of critical race theory is storytelling. Telling these narratives that counter the claims and the narratives of the dominant group. So rather than saying, here is evidence that there is discrimination in hiring. There is, by the way, right. I can give you actual evidence. But rather than saying that, they would just tell a story to counter your claim that there is no discrimination. So that happened over and over and over again. But when you really press people and say, well, what's the evidence that there's actual discrimination? They would, by and large, not entirely, but by and large, just point to disparities. So a great example that we probably can, that's not controversial or less controversial, would be gender disparities. Why are there so many women in certain fields and so many men in certain fields? Now, to a third wave or whatever you want to call it, fourth wave, second wave feminists, they would say the disparities in representation in STEM fields between men and women is itself ironclad evidence of sexism.
Explain STEM for people who don't know the term.
Oh, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. So it's basically science and math fields. There are not enough women in those fields because of sexism. Well, you say, well, are you sure? Maybe women just prefer other fields. And in fact, there's actually quite astounding evidence that is certainly a factor. It's not the only factor. There is sexism in sciences. I agree. But one of the factors is certainly choice. There's evidence, you can look at Scandinavian countries, where there's incredible amounts of gender equity, and women still gravitate towards sort of interpersonal fields like nursing, childcare, education, and men gravitate towards fields that are object-oriented. There's really fascinating data. But the point is, ignore that. The point is just this. By definition, they would say. That if you see disparity, it's because of oppression. And then they would say, wait a minute, what if it's about choice? They would say, but those choices were the result of people internalizing the norms of the patriarchy.
Yeah,
no one makes free choices. Women are conditioned to be feminine by the men. Men tell them you have to be gentle and loving and nurturing, and that shapes their choices. So even when it looks like free choice, it's not really, because they've been conditioned by hegemonic norms.
So this is another one of those examples in Mia where it's just impossible to falsify the idea, because they always have some explanation disqualifying the information. For one, for example, they don't believe in natures. So they're not going to say that men have a different nature than women, and this is what drives men in one direction sometimes, and women, generally speaking, in another direction. That's not. That's all part of the hegemonic oppression.
Power.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The intersectionality is nearly interchangeable with anti-essentialism, which means that they do not believe that these categories have essences. There right. is no essential male and female. It's all, and there's no, when it comes to race, things like black and white, they're right. Black and white as categories that we use today are socially constructed. The meaning we give to them are socially, they're right about that. They're wrong about male and female, though, because as Christians, we're like, no, God created the male and female.
Sure.
And they would say that across the board, pretty much, I can't think of any examples where they would say that there is an essence of any of these categories. They're all exertions of power. Race, mm-hmm. class, gender, sexuality, gender identity, all of these things are constructed by hegemonic discourses by the people with power.
When we come back, we have to take a quick break, Neil, and my guest, Dr. Neil Shenvey, and we're talking about critical theory here. The ideas that are almost completely shaping public discourse now. It's hard to avoid these conversations or these issues, and it's easy to get tangled up in them without understanding them, particularly as Christians who hold a worldview that flies completely in the face of the worldview of those who hold to critical theory. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the impact of this on Christians and how Christians have in some ways unfortunately bought into some of these ideas and how it influences the church, and maybe some ways about how we can speak to this issue with people that we encounter who hold to these notions of critical theory. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, back in a moment.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org and click Connect at the bottom of the page.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and my guest, Dr. Neil Shenvey. We're talking about critical theory. Some people might just simply characterize it as identity politics. I think that's an offshoot of critical theory. But there is a whole way of looking at reality that's at the heart of these things, and that is dividing reality into two groups, the oppressors and the oppressed. And I think one of the reasons, Neil, that this is sometimes attractive to Christians is because there are genuinely oppressed people and there are oppressors. And Christianity as a social group in history has been on both sides of that that equation, oppressed and oppressor. And so I think I can understand the sympathy some people would have, especially when there's an emphasis. This would be the fourth element of critical theory. You mentioned the social binary, oppression through ideology, two, the lived experience as three, and then the emphasis on social justice, because this is the way to kind of set everything right, is we pursue social justice and we get rid of the oppression. But even so, when Christians get pulled into this, it seems they get sucked into an overriding worldview that is completely different to Christianity and turns out to be hostile to Christianity as a worldview, principally, I mean, for a number of reasons I can imagine, but one of them is because Christianity holds to a specific ideology, which holds to be correct. And that view would be oppressive by definition, according to critical theorists, I suspect.
Oh, yes. I mean, Christian privilege is listed on these tables. Like, Christians impose their Judeo-Christian norms on society and justify. And think about it. God is the ultimate oppressor. God has these standards he imposes on everybody else and says that they justify why he's God. The entire meta-narrative of critical theory is just fundamentally opposed to a Christian reading of reality.
Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about Christians here, especially students who are in the university who are facing this. And I can think of two different types. Because this, would it be fair to say that the university environment is thoroughly infused with these concepts?
It is heavily infused with them, yes.
Yeah, even Christian schools.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes, okay. So Christian students in particular in the university or recently out of the university are aware of these difficulties, and there are two concerns as far as I can see. One of them is being taken in by this because of concern about the issue of justice, but then suddenly being drawn into a false worldview. Others who are not vulnerable to that but still want to be able to speak truth into that environment, how are they going to do that when their whole notion of the truth they speak is part of what critical theorists oppose? So that's an apologetics kind of question.
Yeah, it's a good one. I mean, one thing I always say to people, well, first of all, I find it's a little encouraging when I speak to Christians about these ideas and I really unpack what they entail. So I say, you want to dismantle social injustice? They say, yes. And I say, well, critical theorists define injustice in terms of discriminating against people on the basis of their race, gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, etc. That's all oppression. You want to dismantle all of that? And they say, well, and I say, wait a minute, because you have to dismantle all gender roles, gender norms, sexual norms, biblical morality, the Bible itself being a narrative that's true and objectively, you know, right. All of that has to go. And they say, well, I don't want to do that. Okay, I said, okay, then you cannot embrace these ideas. Uh-huh. The other side, though, is that for, say, more conservative, politically conservative Christians who see something's wrong with this, they don't buy it. How do you reach people that are influenced by it? What I'd say to them is we have, and that's me. I mean, I'm politically conservative. I don't talk about it very much. I focus on ideas and theology more than about politics. But I would say make sure they realize that you're not dismissing injustice. You agree with them. You hate racism. You hate sexism. You hate genuine oppression. You agree the Bible is totally opposed to all forms of wickedness, including oppression, but that we have to define these things biblically. When they realize that you really do believe those things, and they can see in your life a hatred of racism, a hatred of sexism, a love for justice, a care for the poor, when they see those things in your life, they'll be more willing to listen to the truth that you're telling them about how critical theory and in Christianity are incompatible. So that's just a way to relate to people. I find that once you undermine the claim of critical theorists, that your motivation is selfish. You know, you're claiming to be concerned about critical theory, but really you're trying to control them. You're trying to gain power and justify your own privilege. That's the claim that critical theory makes. If you show them that's not true, I do care about the poor. I do care about justice. And yet I have equal concerns about this false worldview. Then they will listen to you.
It seems to me in situations like this and ideologies like this, I've reflected on this for a long time as I've seen the changes over the last 50 years, that when there's a concern about women's rights and the idea should be kind of a gender blind environment, eventually gender becomes everything. When the environment ought to be racially blind, then race becomes everything. It's just the dynamic of these crusades of sorts, and where you should be sexually blind, each to his own. Why should we judge people based on their sexual behavior? Now sex becomes everything. And so it's almost like these groups become inadvertently and unwittingly what they hate. And I see in this case, when you have these characterizations of oppression as a characterization of the culture divided into two groups, oppressed and oppressors, and they are the oppressed ones. Their answer to oppression isn't social justice. It's just, in fact, it's just reversing the roles where they can be the dominant force and oppress others. And that's why when I see Antifa out there at Cal, you know, with all their black clothing on and big shields and clubs with blood on them saying fight hate. It's such an irony and such a contrast.
See, that's the point is they've redefined oppression. So they don't see hitting someone with a club as oppression. Oppression has to do with ideology, like norms and imposing your norms on other people. So they it's all consistent internally. Well, a lot of it is, but that's why I'm saying it's a worldview. People think they can accept just critical theory with respect to race or maybe just gender, but you can't do that. Like it's all encompassing. You know, ask any contemporary critical theorist whether you can be, you know, a feminist, anti-racist. I mean, okay, here's an example. Ibram Kendi, who wrote the book How to Be an Anti-Racist, says in that book, you cannot be an anti-racist and be homophobic. You cannot embrace anti-racism and also hold to basically a biblical sexual standard. You can't. He's telling you can't. So Christians who think they can are just flying in the face of what they're being told by critical race theorists or by anti-racists. So now, if you want to just redefine all these terms again, I guess so. But again, people aren't doing that. People are not being discerning and realizing this is an entire worldview. And they're just embracing it unknowingly. And then, you know, in 2 or 3 years, you're going to be carried downstream theologically.
Do you see a kind of cannibalism going on in this movement where I'm more woke than you type deal? And if people are not woke enough, so to speak, then they become subjects of attack by the left and the critical theorists. It seems to me this is happening in places like Harvard and I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. And again, if you have 3 hours, Greg, we could go on and on. There's so much makes sense once you understand the theory. So a good example would be the conflict between radical feminists and transgender activists, the so-called TERFs, trans-exclusive radical feminists. They're the ones who think, hey, you can't just declare yourself a woman, right? Not everyone's a woman. You can't do that. If you do that, you'll totally erase feminism. These are obviously not Christians. These are just radical feminists saying these things, secular feminists. And on the other side, you have trans activists saying, no, that's bigotry. You just hate transgendered people. So you have this vicious war between radical feminists and transgender activists who, in our mind, are both sort of radically far from Christian teaching, but they're enemies of each other. And I think – so why do you see that, though? Why do you see the same thing happened with the white feminism versus womanism movement? It's complicated, but basically black feminists are very critical of white feminists because they leave out race as a category.
Yeah.
Why do you see that happening? And this is a good way to close, I think, our interview. As a meta-narrative, critical theory is a whole arc of our problem is oppression, the solution is activism, and the goal is the promised land of equity. And it also provides a lot of what Christianity provides. The original sin is racism or sexism or oppression. And what does that have to do with this cannibalism? The reason people are so angry and bitter and they're always looking for problems and they're always feeling hurt is because critical theory gives them a sense of justification. They feel righteous because they're woke. That gives them a sense of goodness. I know that I'm a good person because I care about – I'm not saying it's a bad thing. They say, I know I'm valuable. I know I'm good. I'm on the right side of history because I care about racism, sexism, poverty, oppression, transphobia. And then when you tell them, hey, your worldview is false, you're not just threatening their ideas, you're threatening their righteousness.
Yeah, right.
And in order for a Christian to preach the gospel to people who have embraced this idea, that we have to shake their righteousness. We have to show them that God cares about oppression. He really does, but he also cares about sexual purity and honesty and, right. And kindness and gentleness. And they're actually embracing these ideas so tightly because it's giving them a fig leaf to cover over their sin. And we have to gently say before a holy God who loves the oppressed and who loves the poor and who loves the marginalized, before that God, you stand condemned as unjust. And there's only, and so do I. And there's solution is not activism. It's the blood of Jesus Christ. Right. And he is our righteousness, not tweeting the right people or voting for the right candidates. He provided atonement, and only he did that. And we can't be saved any other way.
Well, I think this insight of what amounts to kind of a virtue posturing of the critical theorist crowd, you know, I am more woke than you and I am more righteous than you. This becomes the center of their identity because there's no other source of righteousness, I guess, that they can draw from. And of course, all of these things kind of genuinely twist real righteousness and upset the whole apple cart. And like I was referring to before, people end up becoming what they say they hate. Even though they now have clever ways of justifying it or rationalizing it or make it sound like us responding to them isn't really immoral, it's moral because they fight us with words, and so we are defending ourselves with physical violence against them. That's self-defense. Even so, it still comes down to just another sophisticated form of vice. There's so much we could talk about on this, and I feel we've just kind of scratched the surface. I just want to say thank you to you, Neil, and that's S-H-E-N-V-I, for anyone who wants to check Dr. Shenvi out with a lot of these issues on the internet. You've been a great guest, and thanks for sharing your insight with us on critical theory.
Thanks, Greg.
All the best to you. Maybe we'll talk someday about quantum physics.
Yeah.
All righty. All right. That's it for this hour, friends. Greg Kokel here. I'm a little bit dizzy from all of this information, but it has set things in order a bit for me, better than it was before, understanding these issues in our culture. And I hope it has been for you. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.